No justice, no peace. USO, the Middle East. No justice, no peace.
If you can hear me, please come over here, please. Keep moving, y'all.
There was no space for terrorism in Gujarat, but this kind of carnage has created the conditions for the terrorists to emerge on the scene.
Do the honorable thing.
In the haste to go to war, many of us have forgotten the core of humanity, and that's the heart and compassion. And we can't forget that.
Here's a man who, first of all, does not even qualify for the office that he holds.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A bomb that killed more than 180 people in Bali, Indonesia, over the weekend is being blamed on Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network. Defense Minister Maturi Abdul Dajahalil says we are sure al-Qaeda is here, and he linked it to a cell of terrorists living in Bali. But no evidence was offered, and officials, even with the Indonesian ministry, have criticized Dajali for rushing to pin the blast on al-Qaeda. But President Bush shares his sentiments, remarking, "I think we have to assume it's al-Qaeda, but we should wait until the official reports are completed," says Bush. Bill Hartung is with the World Policy Institute. We spoke with him earlier today and asked him about linking the bombing in Bali to Osama bin Laden.
Well, yeah, I think there is something curious about President Bush immediately announcing that he felt that al-Qaeda was behind this, even before there was any evidence. The Indonesian defense minister claimed there was a link, but offered no proof of it. And basically, what it boiled down to was Bush was saying, well, you know, evil people attack civilians, therefore it's al-Qaeda. The other thing being it was a year after the attack on the USS Cole in Yemen. So I think maybe at some point they will do a more detailed investigation, but I really had the impression that they were kind of talking on the fly and kind of trying to heighten this sense of vulnerability among people.
Mm. President Bush referred to the explosion on a French supertanker off Yemen and the attack on U.S. Marines in Kuwait as part of a campaign led by al-Qaeda. And a statement in today's Post, an excerpt from Osama bin Laden's speech, seems to suggest that perhaps Bush is right.
Well, I think the thing about al-Qaeda is it's an umbrella group, and it's in their interest to try to give the impression of being as powerful and far-reaching as possible. So I think sometimes they like to take credit for things that they may have been marginally involved with. And the nature of the enterprise seems to be that it's decentralized. There's a number of groups that have similar ideology and similar tactics, but they don't always, it's not like, you know, people call up al-Qaeda Central before they decide what they're going to do. So I think part of the difficulty is figuring out how much of this is al-Qaeda, how much is this other Islamic fundamentalist groups with their own grievances and their own regions, and I think to the extent that the Bush administration treats it as kind of this monolithic structure, that they may make the same sort of error or disseminate the same kind of misinformation as we had during the Cold War, where there was this notion of a monolithic communist threat, when in fact there were differences between Russian communists and Chinese communists, mm-hmm. and democratic socialist and communist forces in Europe and so forth, and I think that you know, does a disservice to people who want to solve the problem of how to stop this violence.
Mm. But what are the chances this really was al-Qaeda, and what should we draw from that possibility, if anything? I mean, the statement from that has been attributed to Osama bin Laden, an excerpt in the Washington Post today, seems to suggest that any strike against Iraq would be considered a crusade against the Islamic world, and it sort of seems to back up the possibility that perhaps al-Qaeda is involved in this.
Well, I think if there is an al-Qaeda connection, we can expect more of the same in the wake of an attack on Iraq. And part of the problem with this, what the Pentagon describes as asymmetric warfare, is that the United States is quite developed militarily relative to any other country, certainly any terrorist group. But it's impossible to defend civilians everywhere in the world, and if you're dealing with a network that is not going to announce when they're planning to strike or in what country and so forth, there comes a point where you have to question whether military confrontation is really the best way at this, or whether they should be dealing with some of the political underpinnings of this, try to cut off the financial assets of these groups, which would involve getting tough with some close U.S. allies like Saudi Arabia. And so there's some question, I think, in this notion of the original Bush concept of dealing with terrorism as primarily a military problem. And I think that could become even more evident if they go ahead and intervene in Iraq, because probably whatever counter actions are taken will be in unlikely places, perhaps against civilians in various parts of the world, and it's going to be very hard to prevent or respond to those things. So I think at some point, the administration would need to step back and look at some of the root causes of this thing, and not just kind of use this label of, we're fighting evildoers to kind of cover over the fact that they may be using the wrong tools for this particular battle.
Bill Hartung is with the World Policy Institute. India's Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee returned to New Delhi today after a weekend of talks in London with British Prime Minister Tony Blair, a key ally in George Bush's war on Iraq. Vajpayee was seeking Blair's approval of his hawkish policies towards Pakistan. When he didn't get it, Vajpayee lashed out, accusing Western governments of a double standard on terrorism. Praful Bidwai is a syndicated columnist in India and an expert on strategic affairs. He says hardliners in India's right-wing government are attempting to link Bush's doctrine for preemptive strikes to Iraq with what they say is India's right to a preemptive strike on Pakistan.
This is a minority view, mind you, but it's still there. It's very significant, certainly, and the RSS and people like Jaswant Singh, who went and supported Bush's idea of preemptive strikes, while in Washington, he's no longer the foreign minister, he's the finance minister, and he was there for a World Bank and IMF meeting, but he grabbed the opportunity to meet Colin Powell and Donald Rumsfeld and all his buddies, and then issued this statement on his own, saying preemption is inherent and implicit in the doctrine of self-defense, which is an extraordinary statement, extraordinary interpretation. But those are the kinds of calculations that if you imitate Rambo-style sort of, use military force, like the United States did in Afghanistan, then you can somehow tackle the terrorism problem in South Asia, which is, I think, attributed in a kind of knee-jerk fashion.
Indian politicians are also using the rhetoric to crack down and kill members of India's Muslim community at home. India has the second largest Muslim population in the world, more than 150 million people. Aaron Glantz reports from Gujarat in India.
The call to prayer on the quiet streets of the Anand district of central Gujarat. This mosque is one of the few spared from the violent pogroms of the spring, when nearly every Muslim-owned home, business, and place of worship was looted and burned by Hindu mobs backed by the local police. More than 2,000 people were killed, many were burnt alive. This is the Kalor refugee camp. Children play cricket amidst the garbage. Everyone here has lost someone. Some have lost their entire family. Medina Yoki was at the mosque when the mobs came to kill her. From there she fled to her home, but the mobs were there too. So Medina and 40 family members fled to the fields and finally to a neighboring temple. When the mobs came to the temple, 13 of her relatives, including her husband and brother, were burnt alive. All the while, the police stood by and watched.
When the mob attacked me, they attacked my husband first. It was in front of my eyes that they killed him. And then they threw him in the temple for burning. But since there were so many people and so many children crying, I managed to escape while they were busy killing other people. So it's just a chance that I escaped, but I know my husband is killed, even though I haven't seen his body. I have no hope.
None of the families in the Kalol refugee camp have returned to their homes. Many of their homes have now been taken over by Hindus, with the acceptance of the police and the local and regional authorities. And none of the survivors in Kalol camp have seen the bodies of their deceased relatives. Mukhtar Mohammed runs a steel foundry and started the camp.
There were 65 deaths in this area in Kalol, and the police first said they had 23 bodies. So I went to claim the bodies because we wanted to bury the bodies according to the Islamic religion. We said, give the 23 bodies to us, and we will at least have a proper burial. And we had dug up two big graves because they were totally burned, so we thought we would have mass graves. But when we went to claim the bodies, we were told by the police that the bodies had already been disposed of. The police burned them all.
India's central government in Delhi is run by the same right-wing Hindu fundamentalist party as the state of Gujarat, the BJP. Since the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on September 11th last year, government-sponsored attacks on Muslims in India have increased. Harsha Hedge is an orthopedic surgeon who's treated many of the victims of Gujarat.
If September 11th had not happened, I don't think these groups would have been in so much of a hurry to do it now. They thought that by what has happened in the U.S. and the general message passed out by the U.S. and various networks on the TV and all that, that they were suspicious of Muslim groups across the world. That led to confidence among the people here to start attacking Indian Muslims, who actually don't have anything to do with the other groups of Muslims across the world. They are not so fundamental by nature, and they're more Indian than the other Muslim groups.
And increasingly, India's Hindu fundamentalist government has come under pressure from well-funded hard-right groups that make up its coalition. The leader of one such group, the VHP, told reporters recently he thinks India needs a prime minister like George W. Bush or Ariel Sharon. Government officials here have also increased their visits to Israel since 9/11. And while the meetings haven't officially dealt with arms or policing practices, many here see a crackdown on Muslims as the subtext of renewed ties. Iftikhar Ahmed Khan is a professor of history at MS University in Baroda, Gujarat.
Well, the U.S. war on terrorism has the powerful text. It's not any other kind of terrorism. I mean, it's not anything else than Islamic terrorism. And so if the U.S. becomes the leader in the war against Islamic terrorism, then under the government in India belonging to the Hindu right, there's every reason why they would like to align themselves with that kind of a war against terrorism, because it translates as a war against Muslims.
The villages of rural Gujarat are a long way from Washington and Delhi. Farooq is a small merchant and a peddler, speaking outside a foundry that was reduced to rubble during the pogroms of March. He has this to say.
No one is born a terrorist, but what they have done, the kind of oppression of the Muslims in Gujarat, has come through. It's possible now that many of the Muslims who have seen their young women and children being raped and burned, there is a possibility that some of them will join a terrorist group. There was no space for terrorism in Gujarat, but this kind of carnage has created the conditions for the terrorists to emerge on the scene.
For Pacifica Peace Watch, I'm Aaron Glantz with Miranda Kennedy in Gujarat, India.
At a teach-in Saturday in Boston, Zia Mien, a research assistant and lecturer at Princeton University, responded to the victory of radical Islamic parties in Pakistan's recent elections and outlined possible reactions in the South Asian region if the U.S. takes action against Iraq.
We are beginning to lay the basis in Pakistan for an armed Islamic underground revolutionary movement. Because the fact of the matter is that the policies that Musharraf will follow will be tied much more closely to what Washington wants than what people want. And so the gap will just grow until it becomes unbearable, and then something will break. I think that there's a larger moral to this, though, than just what happens in Pakistan, because what happens in Pakistan has crucial importance to what happens in India. The Indian government is already worried about the implications of these election results. But the Indian government has also started to follow very closely the Bush reasoning over the war on Iraq. Senior Indian ministers have started to talk about why preemptive war is the right of any state, not just the United States. Now, if you're going to make the case, oh, there's an evil man who's ruling a country by force and he's connected to all kinds of bad people and he has secret weapons of mass destruction, well, you know, there you go, you know. And so there is a dangerous tension that is developing, because as Pakistan becomes more fragile, the U.S. becomes ever more dependent on General Musharraf to hold it together and stop it falling apart. Because if it falls apart, then not only is Afghanistan lost, but then much of what, you know, the Bush administration and the oil companies' ambitions for Central Asia are lost also. Because in all of those countries, the U.S. is basically propping up ex-Soviet tin pot tyrants who, for a Swiss bank account, will sell their country and their people. They will not survive the tidal wave that would follow if Pakistan was to go under. And to prevent that, well, you know, the Indians may well feel they have no option but to take preemptive action. There is yet a larger fear, which is that if the United States goes to war against Iraq, it will win, whatever it means to win war in our time. And we've seen enough of that to know. What it also means is that, as people have read no doubt, that now no longer is it just about going to war. Now we are talking about invasion, conquest, and occupation. It is old-fashioned imperialism where Iraq's oil will pay for the US to have fought and won and to rule it. But this is not 1945. And this is something that American policymakers have forgotten, because if they thought about it, it would make them feel very bad. What they have forgotten is that they remember the Cold War. And one of the insights that everybody should have about the Bushes and the Cheneys and the Powells and the Rumsfeld is that they are playing in their own minds the politics of victors. They think, we won the war when it came to the Cold War. This is now ours. And this means the whole world. And when you get into this thing about victors, then you know what comes to victors. It is an attempt to remake the world the way they want, as opposed to the way they inherited it from the collapse of the European empires, when Britain and France cobbled together Iraq and Saudi Arabia and this and that. It's all very untidy. It doesn't appeal to people trained in management. Okay? So, yeah, you want to... Everybody should know where everything is and who it belongs to and none of this other business. But the point is that as the Bushes and so on think about this and, you know, rewind history back to 1945, where they are the masters of all they survey, they have forgotten one thing, that in the last 50 years, there were two wars that took place. Not just the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union, but the war for the freedom of countries across the Third World. People will not tolerate the United States behaving like the British and the French, conquering countries and creating new colonies. They will not tolerate this. We did not fight for independence for 200 years against the British and the French and the Dutch and the Belgians and every other tinpot, pisspot little European country that thought it could push brown and black and yellow people around because we had something that they wanted. Well, that period of history is past. The Vietnamese should have taught everybody this. You do not go and take over somebody else's country. Now, there are two ways for George Bush and Washington to learn this lesson. One will be a slaughter in Iraq, and then decades of violence, where there will be either those people who will step off the sidewalk when they see an American because they are so afraid, or America will realize this is not the world that it wants for itself. This is really what it's going to come down to. That one scene in Gandhi, where they tell him to get off the sidewalk because he's not white. And if this is the way it's going to be, well, you know, it's going to be a horrible situation for a very long time. But the fact of the matter is that the last 50 years have brought home to everybody that wars of conquest, wars of colonization, are a thing of the past, not of the future. And we need that lesson to go very loudly to everyone. Thank you.
Zia Meehan of Princeton University. Thanks to Martin Volker of No U-Turn Radio for production assistance with that piece. A U.S. preemptive strike on Iraq could have global implications, but the decision to attack Iraq may rest with one man, President-elect George W. Bush. But people from the Philippines to Northern Ireland are determined to make their concerns heard. Alicia Littletree, a producer for Pacifica affiliate KZYX, traveled around Europe collecting voices speaking out against a possible war against Iraq.
My name is Pernille Rosenkrantz-Theil, and I'm Member of Parliament for Red Green Alliance in Denmark.
Has there been a debate in Parliament here about the upcoming, seems, bombing of Iraq?
Of course there has been lots of debate about that. My party, at least, is against bombing of Iraq. The way forward is not bombing. The way forward is giving the people of Iraq more resources, because I think the people of Iraq, of course, make a revolution against Saddam Hussein if they had the resources. People of Iraq is very poor, and I think what the United States do by bombing is to make the Iraqi people go closer together. They then get a common, or they get an outside enemy, which make the people stronger around Saddam Hussein. So if the point is to get rid of Saddam Hussein, it's not the way forward to bomb the country, not at all.
My name's Tony Bunyan. I'm a journalist and I work for State Watch, which monitors civil liberties in the European Union.
What do you think the role of the European Union in the US being able to act this way across the world? Do you think the European Union plays any role at all?
At one level, the European Union is not in favour at the moment, right, invading Iraq, apart from Tony Blair. We call them two Christian soldiers who appear to have their own view of the world, which nobody else has. I think the other problem is that we've seen it before over Iraq and over Kosovo, that there were a few leaders and then everybody else joined in. In a sense, what they like to do is say, well, Italy's joined in and they give one gunboat, and then Sweden joins in and gives a submarine, then they've got a big coalition, which of course has no reality. But there's no reality at home in most European countries, and there's no reality in terms of world opinion. So I think, again, we've got this sort of smokescreen coming up, trying to legitimate something which has no popular support. I mean, if the United States wants to go around the world unilaterally removing regimes, then they, quite frankly, are going to create more violent situations. It's a natural reaction. What you have to do is actually start to seriously address, which they've never ever done, and of course it can't be solved overnight. And if they were really seriously to say to third world countries and other people, look, we're now going to make a real attempt to try and solve world poverty. We're actually going to lower our tariff barriers so that your goods can be sold in our country. We're actually going to help you get fresh water, help you deal with AIDS, help you stop kids dying when they're one day old or 5 years old. If there was a real belief that the America and the European Union countries actually believed in any kind of levelling up of the world, yes, they would put to share some of their wealth, then the world might change. But there's no evidence. In fact, the very reverse of it, as far as we can see. You know, I mean, the world wealthiest country giving less to third world aid now than they were giving 10 years ago. And the United States in particular appears to be tearing up every international treaty of worth that it's ever signed. Now, if you're going to behave like that, then you, quite frankly, you're just not going to get respect in the world, and people will treat you as you behave.
The next voice you'll hear is that of Susan George. She's from the French human rights group ATTAC.
I think he's determined, no matter what Iraq does, but he is going to sour world public opinion even more. So I don't want the Iraqis to suffer, that's for sure. But sometimes I think it is going to take something like that to finally galvanize the Europeans into understanding what this regime is. Okay. And I hope that there might be a tiny, tiny silver lining, because this man is really, he is something else. Nixon, next to him, was a flaming leftist radical.
Next is Walden Bello, an anti-globalization activist from the Philippines.
At the moment, the tasks for the people's movements throughout the world are fairly clear. One is to stop the efforts of the United States to wage war in the Middle East, and in particular, to stop the efforts of the Bush administration to plan and carry out an attack on Iraq. I think that the threat of war is very strong at this point in time. As we all know from the newspapers, the Bush administration is relentlessly pursuing its effort to create what it calls a regime change in Iraq. This is a mortal, mortal threat to global peace at this point in time. And that the only real opposition that can counter this is not the opposition of weak governments that compromise with the United States. It is not the compromising position of many European governments. In fact, there is only one thing that can thwart the United States at this point, and that is, in fact, the global unity of mobilized peoples all over the world against this threat of global hegemony.
Finally, we'll hear from Maureen Maguire, a Nobel Peace Prize winner from Ireland.
Now, we're living in a world where in the past we had a military mindset, and that's the way we operated. And we all done it, and we're still doing it in so many areas. So that if there's a problem, there's a military solution. Now, America administration, not the American people, the American administration are now using the approach that somehow they're going to solve the problem in Iraq with militarism and war. It hasn't worked before, and it won't work again. But to try to move that mindset into doing things a different way is going to take a bit of time for all of us. But we have to try to humanize the problems rather than let people get lost in the economics of it. And to humanize the Iraqi situation, we must say no to war. Why? Because there's already a genocide and war going on against the Iraqi children and women. 5,000 Iraqi children under the age of 5 years of age die every month, slowly, from malnutrition and preventable diseases for 11 years. That's a genocide in anybody's books. That figure equals every child in Northern Ireland under the age of 5 years of age being killed. Why? Economic trade sanctions and war put on against people. So we have got to really begin to look at things in a completely different way, because war doesn't work and it's not the way to go. So we have to say very clearly from Europe, and we need the European voices raised very, very clearly, to American and British administration, no to war. The human family doesn't want it, doesn't need it, and it's not reflecting the vast majority of millions and millions and millions of men and women around our world who want food, not bombs. We have got to say that clearly to all our leaders.
That report was produced by Alicia Littletree of KZYX in Philo, California. This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, Kay Bailey Hutchison is the target of a citizen's arrest, and poet Sekou Sondiata on Bush's war.